step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino. With cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the show, and thank you all for being here. Before we begin, I'd like to say a special thank you to our newest supporters, Angela, Heather, and Christina. We appreciate your generosity. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit us at patreon.com/paranormalmysteries or at buymeacoffee.com/paranormal, where you can make a one-time donation. And don't forget that reviewing, sharing, and subscribing to the podcast helps to support us as well, and we thank you. And now, I hope you all enjoy episode 84 of Paranormal Mysteries, The Roswell Interviews, Part 2. Welcome to the show once again, everybody, and as always, I am your host, Nick Ryan. Last week, we began our series called The Roswell Interviews as we listened to Glenn Davis describe his involvement with the case. Today, we'll be continuing on that journey, and we'll be listening to the interview of Gerald Anderson, who claims that he was an eyewitness at the scene of the UFO crash. This interview was recorded on July 24th, 1991, and Mr. Anderson is being interviewed by nuclear physicist Stanton Friedman. If you found Glenn Davis's interview from Part 1 interesting, I believe that you'll find Gerald Anderson's report even more intriguing. So without further delay, let's begin Part 2 of the Roswell Interviews.
This is Stanton Friedman. I'm a nuclear physicist with a very strong interest in flying saucers. I'm in Kansas City, Missouri on July 24th, 1991. I'm here to do an interview with Gerald Anderson, a very important witness with regard to the recovery of a crashed flying saucer in New Mexico in July 1947. We have just had a visit with a polygraph examiner who says he has seen no evidence of deception. This is after spending several hours with myself and Gerald, mostly with Gerald. A full report will be forthcoming. So with that, we will talk to Gerald Anderson. You state your name, please.
My name is Gerald Anderson.
Where were you born and when?
I was born October 4th, 1941, in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Okay, and give me a summary of what happened in 1947 with regard to a crashed flying saucer in New Mexico.
Well, we had just moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico on July 4th, 1947. This was approximately the day before San Augustine with my Uncle Ted, my cousin Victor, my father, my brother Glenn, and myself. We drove down to the plains of San Augustine, which is west of Socorro, New Mexico, in the Magdalena Daddle area, and we were down there looking for banded and moss agate, which according to my Uncle Ted and my cousin Victor was prevalent in the area, my brother being amateur rock hound and wanted to get some of this, and it was a way of showing us around the area. And they had relatives down in Magdalena that they wanted to introduce us to. And so we had gone down there, and we got down in the Horse Springs area and had driven off onto the plains down an old rutted road for a mile or so. And seemed like a long ways. We parked the car, got out of the car, and walked down a hillside, a semi-forested, I guess you could say. It had pinyon trees and scrub oak and stuff like that on it. And we'd walked to, well, not scrub oak, but to cedar, and walked down the hillside into an arroyo, a dry wash, and then walked south down a dry wash toward where the agates were supposed to be at. And as we came around a bend in the arroyo that had pinyon and cedar trees growing on it, we were able to see farther ahead down the arroyo, and on the next ridge line there was a large silver disc-shaped object was embedded in the side of the ridge line, and there was debris and wreckage and stuff strewn about the area, but mainly this thing was intact. I would estimate its size from an adult perspective to be something like 35 feet in diameter. I've heard other people who were there say they thought it was like 50 feet, but as an adult I would say about 35 feet in diameter, quite large. When we got up to it, there were four bodies there, not human. There was two of them who were obviously dead. One of them was obviously very badly injured, and one of them apparently suffered no ill effects, or didn't appear to be injured, and was ambulatory, was mobile. I was just sitting there next to the one that was still alive and appeared to be
badly. Were they right next to the vehicle?
Right next to it, right under the edge of it. And this craft had apparently come in from the east, bounced off one ridgeline, went plowing through this arroyo area, and it crashed into the ridgeline and embedded itself. And they were sitting back under the edge. It was kind of tilted up like this, and they were sitting back under the edge here. And I'm assuming that this one creature that was all right had laid this material on the ground, but it looked like unrolled the tinfoil that these other three creatures were laying on, like it was trying to, like you do a person in shock, you know, put them on a blanket kind of a thing. And apparently it had some boxes there around it and had apparently been trying to give first aid or help these other creatures when we first got there. And as we approached, the creature drew back like this, like it was in fear of us, like we were going to hurt it. And it wasn't very long, you know, trying to communicate with it, the adults were. It seemed to calm down and just sat there and kind of looked back and forth, watching them, apparently trying to figure out what was going on.
Like, what did it look like a little bit more?
These creatures, all of them were about 4 foot tall, four and a half feet tall. They had very large heads that were shaped larger on the top, and they kind of tapered down. Not to a real sharp point, but just tapered down to where they were thin. And they had very large, oval-shaped or almond-shaped, I guess you could say, black eyes. They were so shiny, they had almost a bluish tint to them when the light reflected off of them. Their skin coloration, I think the best way I could describe that is kind of a bluish-tinted milky white. It looked like someone in shock. And the ones that were laying on the ground were really, really looked more that way, more blue,
How about ears, nose, mouth?
No, there was no visible ears on the creatures, except like if you was just to cover your ear like this, to where there was just a rise there and then a hole, without your earlobe and, mm-hmm. and the rest of the ear there.
How about nose?
It was the nose was very, very small, almost imperceptible, and just like two holes straight in. And the lips were just a straight line, just like a cut. And you couldn't see any visible lips like we have. It was just a slit. And
what
it never
color?
Made a sound. Pardon?
What hair color?
There was no hair. They were completely bald.
And no sounds?
I never heard a sound of one, not out of any of the creatures, including the one that was...
Did you see fingers?
Yeah, they had fingers like this. They didn't have a little finger. They just had the thumb, had three extra digits, except the center digit was longer, and the other two were about the same size. They were very long and slender. It looked very delicate, and I've made the statement before, and I'll make it again. I think it would have made excellent violinists because of the structure of their hands. They were wearing one-piece suits. All of them were dressed exactly the same, and it was sort of a real shiny, silverish-gray color.
No zippers, buttons?
No, I saw no zippers, no buttons.
Insignia?
No insignias. The only thing that was different, they all had this, but the only thing that was different from the silvery gray thing suit was that down like the seam on the, like it was a seam on the shoulder and around the collar, it was trimmed in what appeared to be maroon, like cording. Then the suits were continuous with their footgear. You could see right about this area down, it seemed to be less pliable than it was up here, like this was a stiffer area, like it would boots or shoes or something. But they were all dressed exactly the same.
Okay, so you and your family are talking back and forth, wondering what was going on. What did your family say? I mean, did anybody say anything?
Yeah, my brother, one of the first remarks I heard made was, that's a goddamn spaceship. There was bodies up there, and I was told not to go up there, which I did. And
how old was your brother at the time?
He was in his early 20s, I think 20 months, something like that.
He was a lot older than you were.
Oh yes, considerably. When we got out there, I kind of meandered off to one side. This thing was cocked up, and I was standing here. The bodies were here, and everybody else was kind of down here, except my cousin Victor was over here playing, looking in this gaping hole on the side of this disc, and it's shaped just like a discus, except for a round dome was up on top, and there was this big gaping gash in here where you could see inside, and it looked like a double hull.
How big a length?
The
gash?
The dome? Well, it covered the greater majority from the center of the craft out. It was just like a gaping hole in there. And I'm thinking, it's like about 30 feet, 35 feet in diameter, so we're talking like 17 feet maybe.
Uh-huh.
And most of that one side was ripped open like that. And you could see inside, and you could see another double hull like in there, and there was these rows of components that was on there, and there was lights that flashed on and off. Some of them were steady, some were flashing. There was a lot of debris and stuff hanging out of the hole. There was evidence that there had apparently been fire. It looked like it had been burnt along the edge there, the gash.
Now, this wasn't a gash that could have been caused by the thing coming into the ground. It wasn't at the leading edge of the vehicle.
No, this was in the side. Like, it almost appeared it was elliptical. It almost appeared as if something the same shape as the disc we were looking at had hit that same, had hit the disc and left an imprint that pretty closely approximated the outside diameter of the disc itself. And it appeared to be caved inward.
Okay.
And kind of like, you'd hit it like this and just crumpled and caved in and ripped it open.
Okay, so you're there, you take all this and everybody's mystified. What were the circumstances outside? Hot, cold?
Very, very hot. Well, to me, being the first time in New Mexico and coming from back east, that dry heat was just like being inside of an oven. It was unbelievable to me. And that was the odd part about this thing. The closer you got to it, the cooler it was. And standing under it in the shade there, next to these creatures' bodies, it was like refrigerated air conditioning. And
did you feel air coming out of this thing? Or
no, it was just like it was ambient. And I remember reaching up and putting my hand on the side of it, and I think I was afraid it was going to hit my head, because there was enough room for me as a small child, I was approximately the same size as these creatures, to walk up under there and stand there, but I kind of did like that, put my hand up against this thing.
What did it feel like?
It was ice cold. It felt like it just came out of a freezer.
Was it smooth? Was it rough?
It was very smooth. It had a very smooth texture to it. It was obviously made out of metal. It was very solid, and it was very cold, ice cold. And there was a smell in the area. It smelled volatile, acrid, like acetone. And that seemed to be coming out of that gash, that smell. But the closer you got to this thing, the cooler it was. So I kind of remained there, and I guess that while they were over here, my father and my Uncle Ted and my brother, and Uncle Ted was trying to talk to this thing in Spanish, and of course it didn't understand a word he said. And Dad tried to talk to it, and then they tried, sign language, and that didn't work. And I don't know, for some reason, I just, I reached down and touched it, this one that was laying next to me. And when I touched it, I realized, I jumped back. It scared me and startled me, because I suddenly realized that these weren't dolls. I thought they were plastic dolls. And I was still in my mind that these are moving dolls, until I touched it and I realized, this was a dead thing. I'd seen dead relatives before, and I unfortunately had made a mistake one time touching a relative that was in a casket, and I just knew this is a dead thing. And it scared me, and I ran around behind my father and my uncle, and this thing was sitting there on the ground, and it kept looking back and forth, and it just had its hands like it's in its lap, and it just kept looking back and forth between the three of them, and like it was trying to understand. And all of a sudden it just turned and looked right straight at me, between my Uncle Ted and myself. And this is when it was just like an explosion of things in my head, things I started, feeling just terrible, depression and loneliness and fear, and awful feelings that just suddenly burst into my mind. And I don't know if that meant that it was communicating with me and I was the only one there I could communicate with because I was a kid. I don't know. I turned and ran, and I ran across the arroyo and up on the area that it had bounced off of during the crash, and was just standing or looking down at this scene, and my family, and off in the distance I could see cattle grazing, I could see a windmill, and I could see dust trails out on the playa, out on the plains out there. And I was there for a little while, and then I came back down, and I guess we were there, Victor was in, when I got back down there, Victor was up in the crack, and Ted yelled at him to get out of there, and Glenn went over and grabbed him by the belt and jerked him off.
That's your brother.
Yeah. And jerked him off and said, "Get out of there, you could cause this thing to explode and kill us all," and then of course he went prowling around in there. I was kind of standing off to one side looking, that's why I knew that there was, I could look off these rocks that I was standing on right into this thing. That's why I knew, about the lights and the components and stuff. And then, I heard other people talking, and I turned, and there was a group of people coming up the arroyo from out on the plains. From the south, they had come up there, and of course they walked up and was talking. And
how many?
There was an older man and five younger students.
Boys, girls?
There's three boys and two girls, and they were all, introducing, talking to my father and my uncle and my brother.
What did the older one look like?
The man. Leader of this group, yep. The man. He was a very tall man, very big man. He was wearing a pith helmet when he first came up, one of those kind of explorer helmets. And he was bald, and I know that because he had taken it off and he had done this, a couple times with a handkerchief and put it back on. He was a balding man. And he had a round face. He was very ruddy complected. He's a big man. And he apparently was a doctor, because they kept calling him doctor. And as I understand it, it was an archaeological group. It was out there on some kind of summer thing, and they talked, and he apparently was able to speak several foreign languages, and he tried to talk to this creature several times in different languages, again to no avail.
How did he happen to be there? Had he seen the thing?
Well, they claimed that they said they saw this thing come down the night before, flaming, and they thought it was a meteorite. And they had talked about, well, in the morning, you know, we'll go over there and see this, where this meteor came down, because that's what they thought it was. And when the sun came up the next morning, you know, and they got about their business and got up, and somebody looked over and said, you know, they saw all the shiny metal and stuff across the plains there, and they realized it wasn't a meteorite, it may have been an airplane that crashed. So they all decided to go over there and see if there was anybody who was alive, you know, that was hurt, that needed help.
They had driven over?
No, they walked over, apparently, the way I understand it. And it's quite a ways across that plain, so it hadn't taken a very long time to do this. Or they may have had a vehicle, I don't know. That's an assumption, I think, on my part.
Okay, so they're around with
but
your family.
But they came across the plains, nonetheless. I'm not sure if they drove or not. I didn't hear any cars.
And then somebody else showed up.
Yeah, they were down there just, 15, maybe 20 minutes, the tops, you know. And they were picking up things, some of the students. And this Dr. Buskirk, that they called him, this one girl went up and said, look, doctor, wouldn't this make a beautiful ring? And she was holding what looked like a red rod, or a red tube of some kind, it was kind of a silvery red. And he kind of snapped at her, you know, and put that down, Agnes, you don't know what that is. I think it hurts you, just don't pick this stuff up. And she kind of said, well, yeah, okay, doctor. And then he went back to what he was doing, and she walked away and put it in her pocket. And a lot of them were doing this, were picking up things and feeling things. I was picking up things and feeling things. There was all kinds of material, metal and stuff laying around. Then we all heard a sound of a motor coming like a truck. And I went back up the incline there to the ridge line, and I could see out there, and there was a truck coming up. It was an old pickup truck. It was sort of a beige color or a tan colored thing, and it had a whip antenna on it. And it stopped, and this guy got out, and he's wearing brown clothes, he's got boots on, and he's wearing a straw hat, just like the kind Harry Truman always wore. And he had wire-rimmed glasses, he was a big man, and he looked exactly like Harry Truman to me. And I, you know, I'd seen in the movie Tone News that
he was president then.
Yeah, I was well aware who Harry Truman was, so everybody was. He was kind of a hero, you know. And this guy looked like him, except bigger. Bigger, and I don't think he didn't look as old either. His hair was kind of light gray, and he walked over there, and they got to talking, you know, with everybody, and he told them that he worked out on the plains out there, and that he made maps, and that he had seen the wreckage from out there on the plains, and he saw the people, and he thought it was a plane wreck, and you know, just something was going on. And he came over there to see. And he hadn't been there but just a very, very few minutes when we heard all kinds of motors and engine straining and stuff. And here comes a military car with a big white star on the side of it, followed by a 6x, which is a military truck with a kind of a canvas wagon type uh-huh. canvas thing over it. And it's full of soldiers that got guns. And right behind that was what we call a 4x, which is like a medium-sized Jeep truck situation. And it had two big high whip antennas, all kinds of radio gear in the back, and a guy back there with earphones and stuff on, and he's, you know, working these radios. And they all pulled up and stopped. And
which direction had they come from?
They came from the north, from the Horse Springs area, right?
So they could have come off the highway there.
Oh yeah, I'm sure that's exactly how they got there. They come off the highway the same way we did. Well, in the meantime, that when it stopped, this black soldier, the sergeant, and the reason I know he was a sergeant, my brother told me he was, and he got out of this car, and then a guy got out on the other side, and he was, Glenn said he was a captain. He told me later he was a captain. And this guy had orange-red hair, and all the soldiers then came running over there, pointing guns at people, and telling them, get away, get away, get away, you know. And when this creature saw these people, the military, he went nuts. He went into an absolute panic, worse than what he did when he saw us.
Did he move around, or just his eyes?
He just
oh, okay.
Crazy. And it was like he was looking
fearful.
For Yeah, like he's looking for a place to run and hide.
But he never got up.
Never got up. He never left the one injured one next to him. And this redheaded officer, this guy was a real butthole. He made all the threats. He threatened to have people shot if they didn't move.
To everybody?
Oh, yeah. Get away, get away. You know, we'll shoot. Get away from there. This is a military secret. You know, just screaming and hollering. And he told my uncle and my father that if they didn't want to spend the rest of their life in prison, they would never say anything about what they saw there. If they ever wanted to see us kids again, they'd take the kids away and they'd never see the kids, you know, meaning me and Victor, that we'd better keep our mouths shut. If we did not, this is what was going to happen. They were threatening people and pushing people. And
the students as well? And Dr.
Oh, yeah, they were hustling everybody. And one of the soldiers pushed my uncle. He had a rifle, I guess, and he shoved him back like that. Well, that was something you don't do to my Uncle Ted. Ted had a violent temper, and he grabbed the rifle and reached over top and smacked this guy and dropped him right there. And Ted had dropped, fight had dropped the hat. This guy's a cowboy. He'll hit you in a minute. And, of course, when he did that, there was bolts opened, and I guess cocking, you know, they were cocking their rifles. They were pointing guns at people, and everybody, Buskirk and Glenn and Dad, grabbed him, you know, pulled him back and got him away. Don't, man, they're going to shoot. Don't do that, you know, trying to stop this. And I think we came very close to having someone shot. Then they really started threatening, you know, and they interviewed me.
Well, did the redhead do all the talking pretty much?
Pretty much, except once in a while the sergeant would chime in and make statements like that to other people in response to the redhead. But mainly it was the redheaded
captain. Was there a name tag?
Yes, there was, and his name was Armstrong. And I'm not sure if I know that from having read it or know that from remembering it, now being able to read it in my memory, or if someone said that to me. But his name was Armstrong, was right here on his uniform.
Now, they chased you guys away pretty quick.
Yeah, they did. And they herded us up like cattle, and they moved us up the arroyo, back in the direction we'd come from, over the protest of this Dr. Buskirk, who said, no, we've got to go the other way. We came from, I don't care where you came from, get your ass up the arroyo. And they ran us up the arroyo. And
so you get to your car then?
Right. Now, they take us up the arroyo, and just below the hill that we came down, they broke us off and moved us up the hill. Now, this whole time, no one has ever frisked us down. No one has ever checked our pockets to see if we picked up any of this material. And this girl, Agnes, still has that stuff in her pocket, and some of the other students had stuff. To my knowledge, up to that point, they had not been searched. Whether they did so afterward, I don't know. They never searched us, ever. They run us back up the hill, and when we got to where the car was parked, where Dad had parked the car up there, there's a Jeep with a guy sitting in the back, and there's a mounted machine gun in the back of this Jeep, and all these soldiers. The Jeep pulls out, we're told to get in the car, we follow the Jeep, and the soldiers go with us, all the way back out to the highway. When we get back out to the highway, they set us right there. They wouldn't let us out of the car. They wouldn't let us move forward. I don't know whether they're making a decision or what. When we got out to the highway, this place was absolutely full of military personnel, military equipment. There was airplanes sitting out there that they had landed on the highway.
Did you see any airplanes when you were back at the site?
Yeah, there was airplanes in the sky, but nobody thought much about it. You know, I didn't think anything about it. I was used to airplanes being in the sky, having, you know, been raised in Indianapolis, Indiana, the home of the Nordic bomb site. You know, the sky was always full of military aircraft. I never thought nothing about it. And when we get back onto the highway, there's observation aircraft, you know, high-winged aircraft, and there's one, what I know now to be a C-47 sitting there, and how we didn't hear that land's beyond me. And how he landed, well, of course, I guess you could land if you're a good pilot out there, because there's no telephone poles or anything. And it was, they had tore the fence down on the north side of that highway, and all this equipment was setting back up there, and that plane was up there, and they were taking stuff out of the plane. There was military ambulances, and there was trucks with wreckers, cranes on them, and there was tankers, like maybe had fuel or water in them. there was just, everywhere you looked, there was military.
And a major recovery operation.
Yeah, it looked like an invasion force. It really did. And they were all wearing these light khaki uniforms. They didn't look like, you know, olive drabs. They were light khaki, and they all had the same patch over there, that kind of blue funny patch with the circles on it was on their shoulder. And a
did
lot
you have any clue as to where they came from? Did your brother or your uncle?
No, I don't know where they came from. I don't think anybody ever ascertained that. There were a lot of them had MP patches, and some of them were wearing nightsticks off of these webbed utility belts. They had nightsticks, and they had 45s and holsters, you know, the automatics and the full holster. And these were the people who were given most of the orders. They had the road barricaded off out there, and we sat there for a very long time, and, you know, we were getting thirsty and everything, and we asked, you know, if we could go back to Horse Springs and get some water. Oh, no, you can't go through there. And right after that, they said, no, you just turn around, and you head out of here now, and you go to Socorro, and this is the redhead again. You keep your mouth shut, just keep going, and don't look back. Well, so we drove away, you know, and Dad and him said, hell with it, we'll go to Magdalena, we'll get water in Magdalena, you know, because that's where John Trujillo lived, their relative of Ted. And so as we drove away, I was looking out the back window, and I could see Dr. Busker and these kids, and that guy that got out of the pickup was standing there, and this Dr. Busker was doing just like this in this redheaded officer's face, and he kept pointing back behind him. And I guess that meant, you know, we got to go back that way, and he was fed up with this guy or something. He was shaking his finger in his face while they were yelling at each other. And that's pretty much the last I saw of the whole situation. I don't know what happened after that, because we just kept going.
Did you get home before dark?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was before dark. Of course, it was in the summertime, so it didn't get dark until way late. And we stopped in Magdalena very briefly, and, you know, and then just kept going. And the adults were really funny. You know, they were really scared. And I had very rarely, you know, well, of course, I didn't know him that well, but over the years, I knew that Ted was not much of a disciplinarian. He really didn't discipline the kids that much. But he really knocked the fire out of old Victor. Victor wanted to talk about what we just saw. He just saw Ted kept telling him, shut up, don't talk about it. Nobody's talking about this. Finally, he just turned around and knocked the living hell out of Victor for shooting his mouth off.
Did Ted work at Sandia then?
Yes, he did. He was he did something out there in the technical area. I don't know.
Had a clearance?
Yes. And
later, your dad worked out at Sandia.
Yes, he did, in security. And he worked there for years.
Until he retired.
Until he retired. My dad had some very high clearances.
Okay.
When we got home, Mom was over at Uncle Ted's house, and Mom perceived instantly that something was wrong. So what's wrong, Glenn? He's again. And then they decided to tell him. Well, when they did, then of course Isabel. Oh my God! You saw demons. You saw the devil, because
Isabel was Ted's wife.
Ted's wife. Devoutly religious Catholic person who thinks anything that isn't a vision of, say, the Virgin Mary or of Jesus is quote-unquote demons, and that's what we saw. And of course Ted, he just put her off. And we really never talked about it much in the family because of the reaction it got. And my dad was really afraid, and so was Ted. And Glenn especially, because Glenn made the statement about when he first saw the military, he told my father, he said, and Ted and everybody there, don't let them some bitches know I'm a Marine. Don't let them know. And of course nobody did, and he was in civilian clothes, so, you know, he had a pair of blue jeans on, you know, and he was in civilian clothes, so, you know, he didn't look like military, or I'm sure his ass had been in real trouble. And they never checked. They just assumed, yeah, I guess, that we were...
Did they ask your names?
Oh, yeah, they took our names. They got all that from my dad. And my brother just very cursory, hard to talk to him at all. He let Dad and Ted do most of the talking, which was pretty smart, I think, under the circumstances. And, of course, they never really asked me any questions at all.
You were just a kid.
Yeah, I was just a kid. And And
well, you first went public with this. Now, let's first square away. All the other four that you were with are dead.
Yes. Yes.
That's been some time.
And my brother died of a heart attack in Mexico City. And my dad died of a heart attack in 78. And Ted and Victor were killed in an automobile accident in the mid-60s, and I assume it was 65.
All right, now, there's a strange diary that's turned up. How did that happen?
Well, when I went to my father's funeral in 1978, a lot of Dad's personal belongings were given to us boys.
You didn't live in the area at the time.
Oh, no.
You'd gone off to the military.
I've been in the military, and subsequently, on return to the military, moved to Colorado immediately. And
your dad had remarried a couple of times. And
oh, yeah. This was, so Dad was on his third wife. And his personal belongings and stuff, you know, were kind of given to my two brothers and myself. And my cousin, Valley Jean, was there at the funeral.
That's Ted's daughter.
Yes. And she came up and was talking to me, and she said, here, you were there, you need to have this too. And she handed me these photocopies. And at first, you know, I thought, well, you know, what is this, Dad's diary? She said, no, it's my dad's diary, but you were there, you need to have this. And then it dawned on me what I was looking at, and because I read a little bit of it. And so I said, yeah, okay, you know. And I didn't want to talk about it at the funeral, because Roz's side of the family, God bless
that's
her.
That's your dad's third wife.
God bless her, I loved her. But they were very religious, and they would have viewed this exactly the same way as Isabel had, as evil. And I really didn't want to have any problems with them. You know, we were kind of on shaky terms. We didn't see eye to eye religiously, so we're not quite good.
But you're active in religion now, aren't you?
Oh, yes, yes.
You're a deacon in the Episcopal Church?
Right.
Okay, that means you actively participate
well,
in
church. Well, yeah, lay Eucharistic minister.
Okay.
So, I actively participate. I serve on the altar.
What do you do for a living now?
I'm a security officer in the state of Missouri.
And you've been doing police sort of work for several years now?
Oh, yes, yes. About 9 years all total.
And you also are going to college to be a nurse, and you've already got a couple of associate degrees from community colleges.
Right, yes. One associate of science and one associate of general studies, and I'm working toward my bachelor's of nursing. Roughly 2 years, I will have my bachelor of nursing. I'll be a licensed.
Now, to be a security officer, you have to be licensed by the state of Missouri, do you?
Yes, you have to be a certified law enforcement officer, which means that you have to have gone to the State Academy, the Department of Public Safety.
So that's not just a pickup thing.
Oh, no, no, you have to
attend
the academy. Yes, it's definite.
Okay.
And you have to work for the state under these conditions. You have to not only be certified, but you have to have prior law enforcement experience.
Now, when we get back to the diary for just a minute, when you were hypnotized by John Carpenter, a psychiatric social worker, and he was asking you questions about the diary, apparently you'd been told that there were a number of copies of that around?
Yeah. Yeah.
Something buried out maybe there too?
Yeah, as I understood. Well, in fact, in conversations with Valley Jean after the fact, after I got involved in this thing through the Unsolved Mysteries thing, I was told that that wasn't the only diary. That what I had was a copy. Well, it was a photocopy.
Okay.
And that there were a lot of these copies around, and apparently Uncle Ted or someone had put these out through different people in the family and friends and stuff for reasons, I don't know, to keep them from getting lost or something like that.
Okay,
know?
Now, when I asked you for the original, you contacted who?
Well, Valley Jean.
That was Valley Jean, okay.
Right.
She was in a convent.
Right.
And she was reluctant to do anything. You had to call a number of times, as I recall.
That's correct.
And you talked to the bishop? Somebody talked to him.
Yeah, I talked to a bishop.
And he convinced her to send the stuff to me?
Yes, apparently.
Okay, because I got it directly from Colorado with a cover letter that strongly indicated that she didn't want any more to do with this. That was part of the agreement. But that she considered this the work of the devil, or words to that effect anyway.
Yeah, I think she's of the same opinion that her mother was.
Okay,
it was the work of the devil. double ended. You see, all I ever had of this was the photographic copies that I had showed you originally. And as I understand it, you received the original.
I received the original from which those have been made. They were partly burnt. She mentioned she had intended to burn them, but because of your persistence and with the agreement that I never contact her, she would send them to me. And as you know, when I had forensic analysis done, it showed that the ink dated from the early 70s, the paper could have been available in 47, so it was clearly not an original. But it was also done before there was any publicity about this case anywhere, because I know I was the first one to get involved.
Exactly.
Now, as you know, we have discovered, not I, but you had identity sketches done by a police artist of the various people involved in this.
Right.
And as you know, there is a picture, several pictures that seem to indicate that Dr. Buskirk was Dr. Winfred Buskirk, who had received his PhD at the University of New Mexico. And you had described him as in his late 30s, early 40s. It turns out he was 39 in 1947. He was bald and been bald most of his life, even up to then. Was there other contact between you and he at that time, as far as you know? Your family and him, or?
I don't know.
Okay,
not to my knowledge. I don't believe my dad had ever contacted him. There's a possibility that Ted may have, and I'm not sure why. I think Valley Jean had alluded to the fact that Ted had been in contact with him, and that they had corresponded and this kind of thing. But as far as any personal knowledge.
Okay, now you didn't tell your story really until the Unsolved Mysteries program was rerun in January of 1990?
That's right.
That's when you contacted them, got my address, Kevin Randall.
Yeah.
We're a little upset that the program wasn't quite accurate.
Well, yeah, that was the whole thing. It started off as a fluke to begin with because everything that I saw didn't jive with what I had seen personally. Yeah. And I guess I was kind of miffed, you know, here all these years I had been primarily forced, you know, by not only by others, but by, you know, my own sense of survival to keep my mouth shut. And wow, here it is, it's on TV, and he got it wrong. And so, I just impulsively called the number and told the lady, wait a minute, you know, that whole thing was wrong. Well, how do you know that, sir? And I said, well, because I was there, that's why. And boy, that apparently pulled somebody's string.
Yeah, and the key thing that was wrong, of course, there were a few mistakes in an otherwise excellent program, was that they had that, the Barney Barnett, the civil engineer story, over near Corona, and you knew that it was over in the plains.
Right.
There's a lot more.
Well, yeah, and then the fact that the thing looked like a tin flat hat or a tin top hat, and it didn't. It was disc shape, and Barney Barnett, or whoever the guy in the truck was, did not drive right up to it on a road. It wasn't parked conveniently next to a thoroughfare, you know.
Right.
And it was just things like that. And I don't know. I just, for some reason, I thought, well, you know, geez, look.
It's already public.
Yeah, the story's out, and let's get it right, you know. Of course, I don't think I realized at the time, you know, how involved this was going to be, but.
What kind of response?
You live and learn.
Now, I got you together with John Carpenter, the psychiatric social worker, and you guys had several sessions, and then we flew out to the site.
Uh-huh.
You're reasonably convinced now that the second time around out there, we did find the exact location.
Yeah, the first time in, you know, it was like 43 years.
And we're in a helicopter.
I was in the air this time, and you know, last time I was on the ground. And so, you know, the landmarks were a little confusing. I was positive I was in the right place. But until we actually got on the ground, John and I, and retraced the route in there that we had come in the car, I wasn't absolutely sure. There was two ridgelines there, and I wasn't really sure of which one it was. And I had the feeling that the first one that I had pointed out was the correct one. But once I went in on the ground on foot with John, I knew instantly that it wasn't that one, it was the other one, and I'm absolutely positive that that's where I was at. There's no question in my mind.
And you will recall that you described the woman who sold you the pop on the way in?
Right.
And we found the older woman there who said that was exactly what she looked like.
That's right. And I'll never forget that lady because I had it with the heat. I'm telling you. Back seat of that 40 Plymouth, down those dirty old roads and stuff, and for mile after mile. And of course, my dad was one of these kind of people. When he got in a car, it was point A to point B nonstop. I don't know why. He just never stopped to smell the roses along the way. And I was pretty sad shape, and I remember that lady quite well.
What kind of response have you had? You went public. I mean, John talked to a newsman. You both talked. He called me. And the Springfield newspaper carried a very straight, very large article, and that got spread around by lots of people. So suddenly you're a celebrity, if you will. What kind of reaction from the people who knew you on campus where you worked, your friends?
Oh, very, very few negativists. There's the noisy negativist, we have those.
But in general,
supportive. 99% of the people were incredibly supportive. Only one professor at the university was of the negativist type that was vocal about it. Everybody else just 100% supportive. Okay. The majority of these people are absolutely convinced, even without this story, that extraterrestrial life forms exist and that the people are flying around out there and moving between systems and stuff. And it's just an unbelievable amount of support.
You didn't lose your job.
Oh,
didn't give you a hard time.
Absolutely not. In fact, I think I can publicly say that my boss is extremely supportive because he is a avid ufologist himself. He's fascinated by the subject, and you won't have any problem convincing him either. And my boss has a master's degree. He's not someone that's untrained observer that's given to hallucination. Most of the people who are the most supportive of me are people with very high educations, very, very solid education, very solid, upstanding degree people, not given to hallucination.
You attended a UFO conference with John Carpenter, and he gave a paper, I guess, and introduced you.
Sure did.
And you've got a response from that audience, too.
Yeah, 100% supportive. I was really quite relieved and made very, very welcome.
Well, you've been interviewed by a number of other people, Linda Howe working on a documentary and so forth, seems to have bought the story. Now, how much contact did you have with Kevin Randall?
A very brief telephone call. I came home from work one day and there was a message on my answering machine, and as you well know, I have a tendency to be hard to get a hold of.
Yes.
And he'd left his number, and of course I had his address and yours, and I had sent cards to both of you and something to the effect, if you want to know what really happened out there, call me.
Yeah.
And he had called and I wasn't there, and he had left his number, so I returned his call. Now, I talked to him very briefly, primarily because I didn't like the man's attitude. I don't feel comfortable with people who call other people liars and charlatans and phonies and say that they rig their research to make it come out the way they want. And when someone starts telling me this kind of thing, then the first thing I want to do is I want to get away from them. And this is exactly what I did. Now, I understand that this man claims that I talked to him for 2 hours and that he has a 2-hour tape of one contradiction after another of me, and that's not quite true.
Okay, there's been no other contact with him.
No other contact. I won't give the man a time of day. Okay. And
has any other investigator, any of the noisy negativists approached you directly?
No, none at all. The only other investigator is you yourself or Don Berliner and Bob Bigelow and John Carpenter.
Okay.
And of course, you're quite familiar with our involvement.
And you agree that on that first trip to the plains, it was you, I, Bob Bigelow, and a pilot in the helicopter.
Yeah, Joe Channing, the pilot, was in the front seat on the left side. I was in the front seat on the right side. You were directly behind me. No. You were directly behind the pilot on the left side, and Bob Bigelow was directly behind me on the passenger side.
Right, and then we met up eventually with Don Berliner and
right.
John Carpenter,
they
and
were
spent
at,
the next 3 days.
They together. Drove to Dattle. They drove the jeeps and stuff to Dattle, and were waiting for us at Dattle when we landed in the highway island out there.
Right. And as you recall, where did we refuel the helicopter?
Springerdale, Arizona.
So it's not far to Arizona, that's the
point. Oh, no, no. It was just a matter of a few minutes, actually. 25 minutes maybe at the max, west of where we were located.
All right. I think we may pick this up another time, but I think that'll do us for now. I really appreciate the time and trouble and effort and all the rest of that, and on to bigger and better things.
I hope that you're enjoying our look into the events surrounding the Roswell UFO incident, and we look forward to having you back next week as we continue to listen to these eyewitness reports. If you've witnessed something unexplainable and you'd like to have your story shared on the podcast, please contact me at paranormalmysteriespodcast@gmail.com or visit paranormalmysteriespodcast.com and click on the Tell Your Story link. All of our contact information can be found in the show notes. Until next time, I hope you all have a great beginning to your week, and we'll see you back here on Wednesday with our next episode. From all of us at the Paranormal Mysteries Podcast, thank you for listening, and remember, don't wait for the unknown to come to you. Get out there and find it.